You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of June 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
What might happen here now, I would imagine, of course, the EU deal with Turkey is not necessarily at stake here. But we're seeing over the last few months this incredibly strained relationship between Germany and Turkey directly, its top trading partner in the EU.
Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief Chris Lord there, as Germany declares the killing of more than a million Armenians by Ottoman Turks in 1915 a genocide. We'll ask, how will Turkey respond? I'll discuss that with my special guests today, Mary Dajewski and Phil Clark. We'll also look at humanitarian intervention in Syria, Hillary Clinton's views on Donald Trump's foreign policy, or should that be lack of, and the EU's views on Polish politics too. That's all ahead on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today indeed are Phil Clark and Mary Dajewski. Mary's a columnist for The Independent and Guardian. Phil's reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, University of London. Welcome both back to the programme. Good to have you with us. We start in Germany, where the Parliament's declared in a resolution today that the killing of more than a million Armenians by Ottoman Turks back in 1915 constituted a genocide, a symbolic gesture, sure to anger many in Turkey. In fact, President Erdogan has already recalled the ambassador in Germany, and he claims the decision seriously affects relations between the two countries. Mary, just coming to you first of all, where are we at, the relationship between Germany and Turkey? It was already complex. Does this add an extra sort of layer of intrigue, complexity to that situation?
It adds an enormous layer of complexity, and it's almost as though when you look at the rhetoric that's been banded around today, the practically immediate withdrawal of the ambassador, you just look at this and you think almost that the Germans and the Turks were sort of spoiling for this fight for a while, that this is an expression of a whole load of other tensions. Some of them have been there for, you know, 20, 30 years, which is the difficulties in assimilating the Turkish minority in Germany, the refusal of Germany for a long time to allow dual nationality, all sorts of tensions like that. And then on top of that, you've had the crisis in the European Union, the migration crisis, the attempt by Merkel to patch things up with an agreement with Turkey. And now, as they say, this.
And Phil, it's interesting. There's certain things which are guaranteed to generate a particular reaction. And we understand the Turkish justice minister has been sort of suggesting that, you know, this from a country that prides itself on things it's done in the past, alluding to the Second World War. I mean, there's certain things which have a pretty clear resonance, pretty clear intention, and there are a raising of hostilities. How much worse, I guess, could this get next?
Not much worse, I don't think. This is a really serious diplomatic spat, and the language that's been used on the Turkish side today is going to be very hard to undo. I think what I find particularly interesting about this episode today is that, in fact, Germany's been quite late in the piece in acknowledging that the Armenian genocide. I mean, 11 former European countries have already acknowledged it as such. So Germany's come quite late to the party here, and I think that reflects just how difficult Germany knows this will now become with Turkey. And I think it's because of all of these issues that Mary's already raised. This has been a very tense relationship for a while. Germany realised that this would almost pull the pin out of the hand grenade to raise the genocide issue, and so it's taken them a very long time to acknowledge the genocide in Armenia.
Mary, that's an interesting point Phil makes about those 11 of 28 EU members who've passed these sorts of resolutions before. Now, Turkey has seemingly been able to reconcile that and to deal with this and retain moderately good diplomatic relations with those other 11. Is it because it's Germany that it's necessarily different?
Well, I think to say that it's sort of stepped over this with everybody else, just not with Germany, is not quite true. That it's something that rankles with almost everybody, and particularly, it has to be said, with France, because France has generally taken such a hard line on whether Turkey should joined the European Union. And it was also one of the earliest countries to recognise the killings of Armenians as genocide. And of course, you know, this goes back to the very vocal, very influential Armenian lobby in France, especially in Paris. So that, you know, there's always, as it were, a domestic dimension here. Mm. But I think that, you know, as you said, there is something particular about Germany. It's not just the relatively large numbers of Turks who live in Germany now, second and third generation Turks. It's also, of course, Germany's own history. And as the Turkish Justice Minister, you quoted, alluded to, this means that I think the Turks take it particularly hard from Germany because they say, well, you, with your history, have the nerve to accuse us of this. And, you know, I think that underlies a lot of what's been going on today.
Well, and there's yet another layer to that, which is, that, of course, if you go right back to, you know, Kaiser Wilhelm II, you know, an ally, of course, of the Ottoman Empire. So it's, I don't know if it's ironic or just sort of bizarre or an unfortunate, you know, mix of all of those things. Phil, do you think there's ways that Turkey should have dealt with its own, you know, the shameful episodes of its past? I know this is a much broader question, but, you know, I don't think there's anyone probably in Western Europe that doesn't have these various shameful episodes. Why the reluctance? Is it because, you know, it doesn't sit with Erdogan's narrative, you know, the strong man who's not bothered by what people think? Is that part of the problem?
That seems to be part of it. And I think actually the general trend of societies that have caused horrendous atrocities in the past is not to talk about them. Mm. And in fact, Germany is one of the few that has, as an entire society, I think, tried to come to terms with the Holocaust. I mean, even in the British High Court, as we speak, there's this big compensation case around Mau Mau crimes during the period of British colonialism. And I would say that Britain is also a society that has blood on its hands, and as a society generally seems very reluctant to talk about the past. So so what I find sort of important and to a certain extent ironic about this current situation is that Turkey could look to Germany as a society that says we have to put a break with the past. Erdogan was in the press today saying the Germans want to hold us responsible, we the current generation, for the things we did in the past. But in fact, it's the responsibility of the current generation to say, in fact, we will differ from our forebears. We will acknowledge that wrong was done, and we're going to try and do things differently now. The Turkish government hasn't done that, and I think it's creating diplomatic problems for itself.
Well, let's look, rather than to history, to the future. And Mary, you've already talked a little bit about the complexities here, whether it's a deal over refugees, the issue of visa-free travel, for example, ultimately even EU accession, which seems, well, as distant as it had for some time. Where are we at on those? I mean, do we just need to accept that Turkey is going to remain an outlier because of these problems?
Well, I think I get the sense that Turkish accession to the European Union actually seemed a lot closer about 4 or 5 years ago than it does now. Mm. And it may be partly because, you know, we're sitting in London and we're watching the whole of the referendum campaign play out, where Turkey has made a sort of entrance and brought a lot of denials as to the speed of Turkish accession or even ever. But I think that Erdogan himself has contributed to this a lot. I mean, we've watched as the sort of the latest tensions and instability in the Middle East, to put it mildly, and the fact that, I would say, you know, probably coinciding with the same period, we've seen the development of what has been called, rather delightfully, I think, neo-Ottomanism, as it looked almost as though Turkey was more interested in being Turkish and becoming the big regional power than it was in joining the European Union. But suddenly, all that seems to have been turned on its head, with Turkey bargaining for this deal with refugees and wanting more money, wanting visa-free travel, and you sense behind all that was a frustration about it being so slow, having watched all sorts of other people join the EU, but it is still back of the queue.
Phil, where do you think we are? I mean, it's hard to second guess Erdogan, because he's a man who changes his mind seemingly quite rapidly, and he's a law unto himself to a degree. But do you think, I mean, surely he must have some sense that because of what's happening, Turkish accession looks a more distant prospect. Do you think he can, I don't know, is he making a political gamble and he can see that it's expedient for himself personally and domestically to play that role of this sort of this maverick, this dangerous provocateur, if you like, on Europe's doorstep? Or do you think, as Mary suggests there, that, you know, there is still a sense of frustration in Ankara that the process is slow and that's somewhere they do need to go?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I think there's a huge amount of frustration in Turkey. And Erdogan's playing a very dangerous game here, I think. That this is not a time to be riling his European former allies and his neighbours. If anything, this is a time for tact and diplomacy, neither of which have been his hallmarks in the past, it would have to be said.
So, just finally, what happens next? I mean, do we expect, I don't know, words of, you know, a conciliatory tone? Probably not immediately or at all from, you know, Merkel, who's really kind of had such a struggle domestically to deal with, you know, the migrant crisis broadly and specifically with the relationship with Turkey, or from Erdogan. I mean, what do your instincts tell you?
Well, I think Merkel herself has been very careful over this. The vote in Parliament was not at her initiation. It was not of her doing. It was something that was actually postponed, presumably under pressure from the Chancellery, from last year. So it was some sort of unfinished business that was brought up again. She actually absented herself, as did leading members of the Cabinet, from the vote, so that diplomatically, you know, she has some cards to play. She can say, well, actually, you know, I wasn't at the forefront of this. This is what democracy is all about. Terribly sorry. You know, time to move on. But I don't think that'll play very well in Turkey, and it won't play very well in Turkey because of the domestic situation and because of the sort of position that Erdogan has taken. And I'd just like to footnote to go back on the Armenian question. It looked, I think 2-3 years ago, it looked as though Turkey was making moves for some sort of gesture in that direction. And there were two things going on at the same time. There was a rapprochement with the Kurds, and there was what seemed like some sort of flexibility on the Armenian question. I think there was even a football match. And we are as far as we could possibly be now on both those questions. And I think maybe there is a real danger that Erdogan is actually playing himself into a corner here, that he will find himself a lot more isolated than he actually thinks, and that if the refugee deal doesn't work, and it may not work, then he's going to be a loser on every front.
Sobering thoughts, indeed. Now, the United States, the United Kingdom and France have urged the United Nations to deliver aid by air to Syria. This after the UN warned that several besieged areas are not expected to receive imminent but much needed support. The UN Deputy Special Envoy for the country insists, though, that a process leading to airdrops has begun. Phil, does this come back to, you know, the US and the UK on one side, Russia and Iran on the other, at loggerheads over how best to proceed, and then the UN kind of awkwardly in the middle trying to sort of broker some kind of particularly humanitarian deal that could help the people who really need it?
Yeah, I mean, this has been the story, I think, of the last 10 or 15 years, is the UN increasingly struggling to know what its role is in these major conflicts, and it's being frozen out in terms of large-scale peace negotiations. It's being frozen out in terms of parties trying to get UN assent to mount military missions, and so the last sort of roll of the dice for the UN is to play this kind of humanitarian role. I think it'll be really interesting to watch these Security Council debates tomorrow, because it's very clear that the US, the UK and France desperately want to go ahead with these airdrops. And in fact, they will do it. I think even if they don't get UN approval tomorrow, they will basically put two fingers up to Russia in particular. But there will be a lot of pressure, I think, from members of the General Assembly and the non-permanent members of the Security Council for this to go through the UN. I think there's a real sense at the top levels in New York and Geneva that the UN needs to be seen again as an active player in Syria and in these kind of conflicts more generally. So there will be a lot of pressure to do this through the Security Council rather than unilaterally or outside of the UN structures.
It's a good point, Mary, isn't it? It's not just, though, for the authority of the UN that's important, but presumably to try and maintain some sort of reasonable relationship between, you know, these two sides, the US, UK and France, and maybe Russia on the other side. Does a humanitarian urgency not, or does it ever overwhelm the entrenched positions that these different factions have?
It's very difficult to say that it does. Every now and again, when it looks as though maybe talks will be joined or maybe the mood is slightly better, then that's accompanied by a new delivery of aid, or, you know, the first delivery of aid. And then everybody expresses disappointment, or at least on the Western side says, oh, it's such a measly delivery and it didn't include what was really wanted. And as was said of the latest aid delivery by road, they said, oh, well, it may have been the first and for something like 3 years, and as such, of course, it's welcome, but it didn't include what was needed. There wasn't enough of it, and what you need is regular deliveries, which of course is true. But I think that that supplying aid and breaking sieges is part of the whole complex of the war that's going on in Syria, and you change the balance by bringing in aid convoys or by airdrops. I think that the Russians would probably prefer an arrangement to go through the UN. They like dealing through the UN rather than directly, and I think they would feel happier with that. I don't think that they're necessarily blocking aid deliveries. They've expressed some support for aid deliveries, but there are practical problems, and there are huge practical problems with airdrops specifically, because they've tried this, and the first couple that they did, actually most of what they dropped was lost. People didn't pick it up, and so it was a huge waste. And one of the points that's being made, I saw when I was looking about this, was that it said, actually, you can't do aid drops in a lot of the places that are most in need in Syria because they're urban places. And if you start dropping enormous crates of aid, you risk killing people. And, you know, elementary as this seems, it's an argument as to why this actually hasn't been done before.
Well, so then do we come back to a more fundamental question, I guess, which is, you know, with these Western countries keen to get involved to ease this crisis on the ground, do we come back to that old question again about, well, then what is their intervention like? If it isn't aid, if we're not sophisticated enough to get this, you know, whether it's food or medicines and the support that's needed to people who need it most, what does that intervention look like? Do we come back to this old chestnut that, you know, does it have to look like boots on the ground or some kind of military assistance of one sort or another?
I mean, you only get into a situation of having to deliver this kind of humanitarian aid if things like a military solution and peace talks have categorically failed. I mean, when you start to see, the World Food Program's talking about somewhere between 600,000 and 1 million people who are in absolutely dire need. So you only get into that situation if most other solutions have fallen apart. The thing that the US, the UK and France in particular are worried about is that if you have this large-scale humanitarian crisis, it will only ramp up the pressure to put boots on the ground. They want to nip this in the bud now before the TV cameras, the radio gets a full picture of what's going on, and there are grisly images, you know, fed back to Western populations. That's the kind of thing that ramps up much greater pressure for some sort of, you know, more direct military intervention. So there's real pressure for some solution to this humanitarian disaster.
And Amir, it's interesting you mentioned that the Russians are more comfortable with even decisions about aid going through the United Nations. They're happier dealing with them. If we do get to a point where some other kind of intervention is required, I mean, presumably there's no means through the UN or otherwise that would keep Putin and his friends happy in Moscow, is there?
I think that Putin and co. would be extremely unhappy. To the point of vetoing a resolution that actually authorised other people going into Syria, because one of Russia's many points, is that Russian forces are actually the legitimate outside force in Syria, because they were formally invited in by the government, which is still in charge. And in entirely sort of institutional terms, they're right about that. And so anybody else intervening would have to have a UN mandate, which would override that. And I think in current circumstances, that would be very difficult to do.
Indeed. Let's move on. Now, perhaps no real surprise here, but Hillary Clinton is going to take Donald Trump to task in a foreign policy-focused speech for being unfit for the highest office in the land, with Clinton attempting to shift her sights and her team's priorities, presumably away from her Democrat rival Bernie Sanders and squarely onto the Republican pretender. She's tracking into territory which should hand her an advantage. Phil, I guess with Clinton's experience as Secretary of State, with her greater, if you like, you know, establishment political authority, presumably it's good ground to go after Trump on the fact that, you know, he's made ill-considered claims about his foreign policy direction. Presumably she can make a play of the idea that he's got the endorsement of Pyongyang, even this sort of thing. Is this fertile hunting ground for her?
I'm not sure it is, but because I think the assumption there is that the electorate cares enough about foreign policy to make a decision on the 8th of November on that basis. And I'm not convinced that this is sort of front and center for the average American. So it's true that this is one of the areas Clinton thinks that she has a massive advantage over Trump, but whether the electorate think that or not is an entirely separate issue. I also think, even though this has been billed mainly as a foreign policy speech targeted at Trump, I also think it will be targeted at Sanders as well. This is also an attempt by Clinton to say, you know, Sanders lacks any kind of serious international engagement. He's never been engaged in foreign policy. He can't be trusted with overseas conflicts and difficult questions like the one about humanitarian intervention in the Security Council and the like. So it's true that a lot of this will be targeted at Trump, but Sanders is in her crosshairs as well.
Mary, that's an interesting point. Do you think that Clinton, you know, realizes that, you know, she still needs to sort of brush Sanders aside, or do you think that perhaps, you know, the focus is more squarely on trying to highlight some of the key weaknesses with Trump? Or do you think her camp will be worried that, as Phil perhaps predicts there, the American public simply isn't bothered one way or the other?
Well, I think it's quite, it looks from her perspective, it probably looks like quite a clever thing to do, because you present yourself as the alternative to Sanders, as somebody with experience, you've done all this before, you know all about it, and he doesn't. And in a way, similar to Trump, you present yourself as the conventional, common sense, experienced candidate. But I think there's a huge problem there, and I agree with Phil that she may think, and her, more to the point, her team may think that this is really her trump card, this is her strength. But I think there's two problems there, and it's not that Americans necessarily won't be listening and aren't interested in foreign policy, which is probably true. But it is also true that some of the things that Trump has said about foreign policy, along with talking to Pyongyang, include America first. Americans love that. European members of NATO should pay their way. They love that too. No more foreign wars. They adore that. And all those are elements where Trump can is easily superior in policy terms for a whole lot of American voters to Hillary Clinton. And they don't necessarily see her time at the State Department as being this huge success. They see her as an interventionist. They see her as somebody who was not necessarily honest in office, because we've had the whole hassle about the emails, which carries on, and she's been unable to free herself from that. So I think there are liabilities in presenting her as foreign policy president in waiting.
Phil, has it surprised you? And I think a lot of people would identify that truth, in that there's a certain kind of bizarre simplicity almost about the Trump message, which does appeal to huge demographics in America. Does that surprise you? I know we kept talking here at Midori House about, well, soon someone will start asking the trenchant questions, and soon somebody will scrutinise Trump enough, and it'll sort of start happening. But it never has. He seems to be as Teflon-coated as always. Or do you think we perhaps should have expected this, given the nature of US politics?
No, I don't think anybody could have predicted that Trump would still be in the race and as powerful as he seems to be at the moment. And you can see that Clinton is really struggling to work out how to land a punch on this guy. That if you try to engage in old style, you know, diplomatic language, and you try to beat him with a rational argument, he just dances around her and says something even crazier and more incendiary, and you see his popularity ratings go through the roof. So it's a real challenge for really an old style politician, as I think Clinton is at the end of the day. You know, someone who believes in structured debate and appealing to people's best interests, and, you know, grassroots campaigning, and not sort of speaking, you know, off the cuff and kind of wildly as Trump has, to work out how to beat someone who's basically playing guerrilla warfare. And I don't think she has a solution to that yet. I think the other thing that we have to factor into this. I mean, not to sort of labour the point about Sanders too much, but he has slowly been closing the gap. Mm. I mean, whether it's enough for him to do real damage, and a lot of this will come down to how these mysterious superdelegates will vote at the end of the process, but Clinton is having also to fight a battle on two fronts in a way that Trump is not. He's 100% focused on Clinton and her campaign. So he has a massive structural advantage in this fight at the moment.
But it's also true that Sanders and Trump have certain policies in common and a certain approach in common, so that the better Sanders does, and the fact that Clinton hasn't been able to throw him off completely till this stage, it doesn't mean she's going to be all conquering inside the Democratic Party. There will be Democrat voters, registered Democrat voters, who on the day in November could very well vote for Trump because he represents this sort of, you know, we're all calling it populism in a rather sort of patronizing way, but it has an appeal, and Hillary does not have that.
Oh, just on that point, Mary, I remember, I think it was a few weeks ago, you ticked me off on this program because I was making these disparaging remarks about Trump and, oh, he'll fade and he's a foolish gentleman. I mean, a few more weeks have passed. He's still doing pretty well. Is there a genuine prospect that he could actually win in November in your view?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think so, and I've thought so. I've thought so for a while, because I think the combination of the policies that he's, you know, everybody said, oh, he's got no policies. Well, actually, he does have policies. His rhetoric will tone down through the autumn, and as Phil said, you know, he is probably the opponent that the Hillary camp would least have liked amid all the Republicans. She would have been probably fine against every one of them except Donald Trump.
Oh, that's a sobering thought indeed. Mary Dejewski and Phil Clark, thanks both for being with us here on Midori House. A couple of minutes early, just because we've got a rather special event happening here at Midori House at the top of the hour at 1900. And I just wanted to have a quick word or two with none other than Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and a frequent presenter on the show as well. But he's got different sort of subjects in sight, Andrew, at 1900. Your show, The Urbanist, it's a special... Well, why don't you tell our listeners what they've got coming up in about half an hour's time.
I've even got a different outfit. I've got a suit on for once. How did that happen? And if you think Donald Trump is outrageous, I've just been speaking to the guests already. I think they're going to be having a punch-up if I'm not careful. They're going to be talking about what should happen to London post the election of Sadiq Khan. Everyone's thinking about the city. And one of the key topics, I guess, was housing, what should be done about that. And I know that some of the speakers tonight, they have very radical plans for what they think that the mayor should be doing. And some of them even question whether a mayor is effective at controlling a city like London and whether you need a bigger committee. So there's going to be some really interesting talk. It's live for 30 minutes here. And then the lucky people who bought a ticket are going to hang around. We're going to continue the debate. And hopefully I'll get them all into taxis without any black eyes.
I was going to say, I've heard tell there'll be a glass of wine or two knocking around. So I hope it all remains very civil. But it's interesting, Andrew, just finally, we think about, you know, the Sadiq Khan success. How quickly do you think people see change when they get a shift in City Hall? You know, out goes Boris, in comes Sadiq Khan. Is it unrealistic to expect miracles? Is that what people want, or are they a bit more sanguine about, you know, what a change like that means?
Not miracles, but I think things have already happened. You know, there's a question over the Garden Bridge, which is a project that Boris Johnson was very keen on. Some people felt it would be like a version of the High Line for London, but then was it going to be private? It's contentious. Some people love it, some people hate it. Designed by the wonderful Thomas Heatherwick, but that doesn't always ease things. He's already said, I'm going to look at this before I sign it off. But today he announced, oddly, which is a strange thing to come out very early with, that he's going to light every bridge in London in glorious technicolour and to pull in more tourists. We can barely cope with the number of tourists now with our kind of creaky infrastructure. So I don't know what they're all going to be doing wandering along the Thames. But we'll find out. Those are the kind of questions, Tom, that will be resolved tonight in a glorious Technicolor too.
Perfect. Well, I hope Sadiq and his colleagues are listening. Andrew Tuck will be bringing you a special live edition of The Urbanist. That's at the top of the hour, 1900 London time. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks, Andrew, for jumping in. Thanks, Mary Dejewski, and thanks, Phil Clark, for being with us, our usual panellists on the programme. That's all we have time for. So thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Granina, and our studio manager, Chris Chilvers. A bit of music coming up next, and then that special edition of The Urbanist at 1900. We're back at the same time tomorrow. Do join us then. Goodbye.